You are indeed. And here comes a guest. Joel Carreau, I hope that's right, is a reporter and editor at the Washington Post. He's a member of Global Business Network and a principal of the Carreau Group, a network of his best sources committed to understanding who we are, how we got this way, and where we're headed. He's also served as a senior fellow at the University of California, Berkeley, and George Mason University. Joel's latest book, Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human, takes an unprecedented, sometimes alarming, always spellbinding look at the hinge in history at which we have arrived. I've never heard it put quite that way, a hinge in history. For hundreds of millennia, our technologies have been aimed outward at altering our environment in the fashion of fire, agriculture, or even space travel. Now, for the first time, we're increasingly aiming inward at modifying our minds, memories, metabolisms, personalities, progeny, and possibly our immortal souls. Radical evolution is about altering human nature, not in some distant tomorrow, but in the next 10 or 20 years. Now, I want to read you a short article that I think bears on some of what our guest, or the kind of thing our guest is going to talk about tonight. Listen carefully to this. Chop off a salamander's leg, and a brand new one will sprout up in no time at all. But most animals have lost the ability to replace missing limbs. Now, a research team at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies has been able to regenerate a wing in a chick embryo. That's a new wing, folks. A species not known to be able to regrow limbs, suggesting that the potential for such regeneration exists innately in all vertebrates, including humans. Their study, published in the Advanced Online Edition of Genes and Development on November 17, demonstrates that vertebrate regeneration is under the control of the powerful WNT signaling system. Activating it appears to overcome the mysterious barrier to regeneration in animals like chicks that can't normally replace missing limbs. And while inactivating it in animals known to be able to regenerate their limbs, frogs, zebrafish, salamanders, shuts down their ability to replace missing legs and tails. Quote, in this simple experiment, we removed part of the chick embryo's wing, activated the WNT signaling, and got the whole limb back, a beautiful and perfect wing, according to the lead author. By changing the expression of a few genes, just a few genes, you can change the ability of a vertebrate to regenerate their limbs, rebuilding blood vessels, bone, muscle, and skin, everything that is needed. Now, although they cannot obviously do it yet for humans, that may be on the horizon. In other words, as we unwind the human genome, and then we begin to tinker with the human genome, for good or bad, a lot of people think it's bad, the ability, for example, to regrow a lost arm, a leg, a finger, a toe, or literally any part of your entire body, something that would not be immediately fatal to you, may be possible to regrow limbs. Can you just sit on that and think about it for a little while? To regrow limbs, possibly to regrow spinal columns, that sort of thing. That may be in our rather immediate 10 to 20 type year future. We'll talk to Joel about all this and more in a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, Joel Carreau. Joe, are you there?
I am.
Joe? Good. Am I slaughtering your last name?
It's pretty close.
Close. Let me hear your version.
How about Joel Carreau?
Joel Carreau.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, that was pretty close.
Yep.
All right. Now, you work for the Washington Post, huh?
I do.
You do. And what made you decide to write this book?
Well, Radical Evolution is about how we're at a turning point in history. This is one of the biggest changes in tens of thousands of years of what it means to be human and how it's happening right now. That we're the first species, really, to take control of our own evolution, as amazing as that sounds. And Radical Evolution is the roadmap to this this turning point for the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years. This is not some distant science fiction future. This is a world that's opening up in front of us right now. You know, you talked at the beginning of the show about how we have our programs going that will allow us to regenerate limbs.
That's right.
That's a program that was started at DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Oh, yes.
This is the research and development arm of the Pentagon. And it's unlikely that they're going to allow us to regrow spinal columns anytime soon. But what they did notice was that even in children who accidentally lose a finger, they will regrow that finger if it's not sutured up, right up until the time that they're, say, 8 or 12. And they thought that, well, wait a minute, something got switched off here that prevented us from regrowing our limbs. How do we switch it back on?
Mm-hmm.
That's just part of the world that's opening up now, in which we're beginning to start creating artificial organs like livers and kidneys. This is part of a broad sweep of technologies, all of which are aimed inward at modifying our minds, our memories, our metabolisms, our personalities, and our kids. And if you can do all that, then you're talking about really changing what it means to be human. And I identify three scenarios about what that means to society. Because even as amazing as all of these technologies are, the real thing that I'm interested in is, where do we go from here? Where is this going to take us as a society?
Well, that in itself is a very interesting question. I mean, you're talking about, I presume, the next 10 or 20 years, if you project from there and add another, say, 50 or 100 years to it, it's almost beyond even the ability of a good science fiction writer to get it right.
Right. Well, I try very hard to keep this in the here and now, and not, I don't make any predictions in Radical Evolution. I talk about what's actually in the hopper right now, what's in the labs. What's going to be happening in the very near future is that your kid is going to be coming home from school again in tears because he just can't compete with other kids who are more athletic, more smart, better behaved, more beautiful, better, more capable, and able to get into the best colleges, and your kid can't. And the difference is that these other kids, their parents have invested in all of these enhancement technologies that are coming online, and you haven't. And when that day comes, you're going to have to decide what you want to do. You've basically got three choices. You can either say to the kid, listen, wipe your nose. I don't care how other parents treat their kids and how they deal with their minds and bodies. We love you just the way you are.
Right.
Or you can go out and remortgage the house again in order to engage in this arms race in which people are increasingly seeing, embodying the old Army slogan, be all you can be. Or you can try to get these kids thrown out of your school, the enhanced kids. But the trouble with that is it just widens the gap between people who are the same kind of version 1.0 human as the one that we've been used to all of these years, and the ones that are increasingly embracing these technologies. I mean, as you say, with that Regenesis program, this is something that you can see in the headlines right now. This is not science fiction.
Oh, no. This is a story that I ran across earlier this morning. Of course, I perused what you were going to be talking about a little bit, but I ran smack into this story about regrowing limbs, and I went, oh, my God, they're actually talking about regrowing arms and legs and that sort of thing as a fairly near reality, and it hit me right between the eyes. Now, there are apparently other enhancements that, you know, are on the rather immediate horizon. What might they be? What might little Johnny have in another 10 or 15 or 20 years that my child, if I don't allow it, might not?
Well, just in the next 3 years, for example, there are four U.S. companies that are racing to bring online memory pills as prescription drugs. These are drugs that would dramatically enhance your capabilities to remember. Like most of these enhancements, they're originally aimed at people who are really sick. In the case of memory pills, they're obviously be aimed at Alzheimer's victims.
Okay, for example, I've heard of, I think it's ginkgo biloba, something like that.
Oh, yeah. No. This is not any of that.
A whole new class of drugs.
No, this is real, no kidding, pharmaceuticals. This stuff works. This makes a big difference. This is not some vitamins or something that you get at your health food store. This is stuff that dramatically works, and it's FDA approved, and it's a prescription drug. And the reason they think this is going to be such a big deal commercially is because they think that, you know, as with all of these enhancements, the second group that wants it is the needy well. And in this case, it'll be the aging baby boomers who can't remember where they put their car. And then the third group that any of these enhancements is aimed at is the merely ambitious. And in this case, it'll probably be our kids. I mean, you think of what parents do now to get their kids into their best schools. Well, think of how memory plays a role in so much education, whether it's language or the law. Well, suppose that in 3 years you could basically buy your kids an extra couple of hundred points on their SAT scores with these memory pills. Already, Educational Testing Service that runs the college boards are already very fidgety about this. They're thinking,
Joel, are they actually talking about a measurable increase in IQ, or just a measurable increase in what you can remember?
These are simply memory pills, but farther down the line are cognition enhancers, which are meant to actually improve your ability to process information. And this is in the near term. Pharmaceuticals are in the first wave of these enhancements that you're going to see actually coming on the market. In fact, you know, we're having this debate on our sports pages right now with Barry Bonds, the baseball slugger.
Of course.
The question in the sports pages is, should Barry Bonds go around with an asterisk on his forehead for the rest of his life because he's a fundamentally different kind of human than the people whose records that he broke? Well, that's very, very primitive pharmaceuticals. I mean, that's just steroids and stuff like that. But incrementally, one prescription at a time, we're looking at a variety of drugs that are going to be dramatically increasing our abilities physically, mentally, socially, and a host of other ways. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. The four technologies that are really driving this are what I call the GRIN technologies, which stands for genetics, robotics, information, and nanotechnology. And all four of these are interweaving, and what they all add up to is an ability to dramatically change who we are and how we function. I can go through the four of these and how they're changing us, if you'd like.
I would like, yes.
Okay. Genetics, of course, you know, what's really driving all four of these technologies is something called Moore's Law. There's a guy named Gordon Moore, who back in 1965, 6 years after the first computer chip, he noticed that the number of transistors that you could get on a piece of silicon for a dollar was regularly doubling. And he boldly proclaimed that this doubling was going to continue for the next 10 years. Well, little did he know. I mean, Gordon Moore at the time was just a lowly electrical engineer, but he ended up becoming one of the three founders of Intel, you know, Intel Inside, the computer guys.
Of course.
And he's
just a little asterisk here. Did you know that Gordon Moore recently said that he believes his own law is going to hit a brick wall?
There's a lot of debate about this. There's no question that that two-dimensional silicon is going to be hitting its limits somewhere in the vicinity of 2015 or so, because the sheer size of the, you know, you're going to be getting down to the molecular size. Now, people have been predicting the end of, you know, computer growth for centuries now. I mean, we went from mechanical computational devices to tubes, and just when tubes were beginning to hit their limit, suddenly we went over into silicon. And, you know, and now silicon is hitting its limits. And the question is, does that is that the end of the road for Intel? Do you think they're just going to quit? Well, there are quite a few different ways of doing this kind of computing that are in the offing. One of them is to start stacking it three-dimensionally rather than just flat, and that would mimic the way the brain works. Another way of doing it is to use quantum computing, which use the spooky realm of quantum mechanics to start producing machines that can work at millions of times faster than the ones we have now. And there are even what they call meat machines, which is basically DNA. And DNA, after all, is just a means that the body uses to do computation. So there's a host of different kinds of computers that are in the offing. The question is, will they become mature in time for the end of two-dimensional silicon? And in some ways, I hope that Moore's Law does stop sometime soon, because these technologies that are coming online are changing who we are so fast that I really think we could use a breather here. But I'm not necessarily optimistic that this thing is going to slow down anytime soon.
Nor am I. It may indeed hit the wall, but I bet just as it gets to the wall, we will discover something in the quantum world. It's interesting. Einstein, referring to entanglement or the whole quantum world, described the whole thing as some sort of spooky action at a distance that he couldn't explain, and that's where he stopped.
Right. I mean, there's an awful lot of this technology that is, in fact, pretty pause-giving. And, I mean, one of them is when you talk about the genetic technologies, for example, what that essentially is about is not just the genome. It means controlling cells at the very most basic level, turning them on and off. One of the things that DARPA is working on, for example, is an ability to create people who can, in effect, have a metabolism like Lance Armstrong at will. The idea is to send soldiers into battle at peak performance and have dominance at the metabolic level over their competitors. That's a really amazing change that you're talking about there. The very idea that you could even think of this. One of the things that they're looking at, for example, I mean, they noticed that you really don't want to have soldiers run out of energy on the battlefield. I mean, the physical energy inside your body.
Right.
And the way that you're creating that now, of course, is by eating calories. But the problem is that a special forces trooper can easily go through 20,000 calories a day. Well, you know, that's just an amazing number of calories. That works out to 3 meals ready to eat and 48 power bars. Well, you can't even carry that much food, much less eat it comfortably. So the question they're asking is, suppose you didn't have to do that. Suppose you didn't have to eat for as long as a week. Suppose instead that what you could do is tap at will the energy that's stored in your fat. Well, they're working on that right now. And when they first started talking to me about this, you know, I'm writing it all down. And suddenly it dawns on me that they're talking about being able to burn your fat at will. And I kind of raised my hand and said, me, give some to me. I mean, how long have I been working out to no effect, you know, and all of a sudden they're talking about burning fat at will. And they kind of smile this little smile and say, the civilian implications of this technology have not eluded us. Dieting is a $40 billion a year industry.
Oh,
in
absolutely.
Country, and this could end it.
This could all end a lot of things and begin a lot of other things. All right, Joel, hold tight right there. I wonder if any of the rest of you have noticed what I've noticed in the last half hour. Joel Garreau has a voice that is so very much like Whitley Strieber's voice that if I didn't know better, I'd say it was Whitley, but it is not. Is Joel Garreau. He's a very interesting guy, obviously. He works for the Washington Post, and he's written a book called Radical Evolution, The Promise and the Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. And I wonder if what it means to be human ultimately is going to mean that we turn into something that from, well, at least a conventional perspective, is not human at all. How enhanced do you want to be? That's a pretty interesting question. Would you like to be able to grow a new arm if you lost one? Well, yeah, sure. Would you like to be able to remember things more with more ease? Well, yes, probably. Would you like your IQ boosted another 100 points? Well, maybe. Would you like eyesight that's, 10-10 instead of 20-20? If that represents an enhancement, I think it probably does. And or on down the line, how enhanced do you want to be? How much money do you have? Joel Garreau is my guest. Joel is talking about that. He's written a book about it, Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human, and if at the end of all this, we even are human. That's perhaps a question that we'll pose coming next. The genetic revolution seems well underway. The promise of nanotechnology is a little foggier, to me anyway, Joel. And as we look at all this, if you go back, I don't know how old you are, Joel, but if I go back to when I was a child, we were all watching movies and news, for that matter, that told us by the time we were in our 50s or 60s, robots would be doing it all for us. We'd have our arms slackly at our sides, and robots would be running everything, and we'd be lucky if they didn't run away with the whole world on us. Now, that never really happened, and right. I wonder if what we're talking about here is an exception to that rule.
Well, yeah. Remember the paperless office?
Oh, and sure.
There's another great prediction, and weren't we supposed to be having hotels in orbit by now?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is why I don't make any predictions in radical evolution. I'm just talking about, you know, what exists in the pipeline right now and what's in labs. And I'm looking at the curve of exponential change that's behind this. I mean, are you old enough to remember when computer screens only came in black and white?
I am, yes.
Do you remember rotary dial phones?
I, of course, do, yes.
Do you
I'm 61, what, Joel. I remember all of that.
Do you remember what mimeograph machine fluid smelled like?
I do.
How about polio?
I you know, Joel, that I was one of the first test subjects that received one of those little sugar cubes that either had a polio vaccine in it, which I later found out it really did, or was nothing but sugar.
Well, see, the thing that's interesting is that, you know, this recitation sounds funny, you know, because it sounds so incredibly antique. And yet, this is stuff that was that you know existed in the lifetime of an awful lot of people on the show. And the question is, well, what happened? Well, what happened was that we've started entering a curve of rapid technological change. And by a curve, I mean that's the important part. Is that at the beginning of the show we started talking about how computers were doubling in power every 18 months. A doubling is an amazing thing. It means that each step is as tall as all of the previous steps put together. And we've never seen a curve like this before in human history. There have been 30 doublings since the first computer chip was built in 1959. And that means an increase of over 500 million times, you know, just since 1959. We've never seen anything like this before. The closest that you can come in the past was that you had 14 doublings of railroad miles in the 1800s in the United States.
Yes.
And that changed everything. That the New York went from being a collection of villages to a world capital. Chicago went from being a frontier boomtown to a brawny Goliath. San Francisco went from being 4 months from the East Coast to 6 days. It changed families. It changed business. It turned the United States into a world power. And yet, that was only 14 doublings. Now, with the computer devices that we're looking at, there are now refrigerator magnets with more firepower than was obtained by the entire North American Air Defense Command in 1965. And nobody really cares, of course, how fast a computer goes. The important thing is that this repeated doubling of computer power opens up windows on entirely different worlds that we never imagined possible before. Genetics is a really good example of that. Mm-hmm. When people first talked about sequencing the human genome back in 1985, there's an awful lot of people who, first of all, didn't think it was possible. And second of all, they thought, well, if it was possible, that might happen by 2015 at a cost of zillions. And, of course, it happened much faster than that. It happened in the year 2000 and at a fraction of the original estimated price. And that's because the people who were doing the projections weren't taking into account this constant doubling and redoubling of firepower that allows us to now open up a world in which, you know, anybody will be able to get their genome sequenced for $1,000 and then for $100 because the underlying gear will become increasingly powerful.
Well, of course, the next step in that category, Joel, is going to be not just the sequencing, but the manipulation. Now, we're beginning the manipulation phase of it. Once you learn what the sequence is, then you can begin to change little things here and there. And that's when you begin to get new arms and legs and organs and all kinds of amazing godlike things happen.
Yeah, well, what happens is that, you know, the actual, you know, changing, you know, designer babies and all that stuff, that's somewhere down the road. That probably won't be commercially common for another 10 years or so. But as you say, before that, we start using the knowledge that we've gained to create new pharmaceuticals on demand and to start actually controlling the body's function at the cellular level. And that's just one step. I mean, the other thing that's going on is robotics, which is, you know, using machines to that are implanted in our bodies to create powers that seem to be only, you know, part of comic book superheroes back in the 1930s and 40s. You want to hear about the telekinetic monkey that exists down at Duke?
I do.
There's a monkey down at Duke University in North Carolina who can move objects long distance with her thoughts. I'm not making this up.
Well, tell me why you believe it to be really true.
Well, because it was written up in Nature magazine and was also funded by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Do you want to know how you make a monkey telekinetic?
I do.
What happened was that her name is Belle, and she's a cute little owl monkey. She's about 8 pounds and very smart. And in order to what they were trying to do was to create a link between computers and your mind directly. And Belle was the experimental monkey. The first thing they did was they got her hooked on computer games. She had a joystick, and if she could, you know, with the joystick, if she could make the cursor hit a flashing light, she got a drop of juice. But within a few days, it became clear that she almost cared about the juice. She was hooked on the computer game. And when that happened, then what they did is they drilled a hole in her head, and they took a tiny device about the size of a baby aspirin that had hundreds of superfine wires coming out of it, and they implanted it in her motor cortex, which is the part of the brain that controls motion, like using your arm. And these wires, the reason they were so tiny, so thin, was that what they did is they lined up the wires with individual neurons in her brain so that when the neurons fired, the wires could sense this and relay the signal directly to a computer.
Uh-huh.
And after they finished with this implant, they sealed her up, and they fired up the computer game again. And she started playing the game, and as she did it using her arm, they watched the signals in her brain, you know, through this device on the computer, and they began to figure out what neuron firings meant what. All right, you with me so far on this?
I absolutely am, yes.
Okay. Then, you know, when they finally figured out what the brain was doing and how it was associated with her arm motion, then they disconnected her joystick. So there was nothing that this joystick was doing. And they fired up the computer game again, and sure enough, using just her thoughts, just her neurons firing, she could control that cursor and hit the flashing light.
Okay, so what they were doing was back engineering the effect they were observing from the neurons that were firing.
Right. And then just to be cool about it, they put the signal on the internet and piped it up 600 miles north to MIT, and there was a robotic arm. And, you know, and they piped the signal into the robotic arm, and the robotic arm began to dance in exactly the same fashion as her arm would have been moving had she been using her arm to play her computer game. And so I would submit that if you've got a monkey that can control a robotic arm 600 miles away with her thoughts, that you've got a telekinetic monkey. And in 2004, we had the first human who was wired this way. His name is Matthew Nagel, and Matthew's not the world's sweetest guy. He got involved in a knife fight, and he ended up getting his spinal cord severed, so he's locked up from the neck down. So he volunteered for a similar procedure, and they put one of these implants in his brain, and he became the first human to send an email with his thoughts in 2004. And he, too, can control a robotic arm. Now, you may wonder, you know, why would you want to do this to a monkey or to a human?
Well, because you could wire up a pilot who could then control his plane with thought instead of having to move an arm, for example. And the seconds or microseconds involved and the difference could be the difference between getting shot down and shooting the other guy down.
Bingo. That's the official reason. An F-22 jet fighter is a very difficult aircraft to control with a joystick. But the notion that DARPA has is, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could blur the distinction between the made and the born, between humans and machines, and that not only could you control the machine directly with your thought, but it would be a two-way street, such that whatever the machine senses, whether it be radar or long-distance sensing or heat or stress or whatever, suppose that were piped directly into your brain, bypassing keyboards and screens. They think that would be just a wonderful melding of mind and machine. That's the official reason. But the real reason is that at the time that this was being put forward at DARPA, the guy who ran the Defense Sciences Office, which ran that show, his name is Michael Goldblatt, and he has a daughter named Gina Marie. And Gina Marie is a very talented young lady. She just graduated from the University of Arizona, bilingual, very talented, and she's got cerebral palsy. So she is supposed to be spending the rest of her life in a wheelchair. Well, her father, Michael, is way up front about the fact that he has spent untold millions of your taxpayers' dollars on this mind-machine interface. Because if you can control a machine with your thoughts, there's no reason, theoretically, that those machines couldn't be in Gina Marie's legs. And the day that that happens is the day that Gina Marie will be able to get out of that wheelchair and walk. So Michael Goldblatt has been spending an awful lot of this mind-machine interface money to save his daughter. And that's just one of the, you know, many incremental, small, step-by-step advances that starts really challenging, you know, what it is that you view as the normal capabilities of human beings. An awful
General,
lot of
people. You're a very optimistic, obviously, a very optimistic guy. I'm not as optimistic. I see the same changes that you see, but I worry that eventually we blur the distinction of our own humanity. I mean, as we become part human, part machine, are we not so sure what we are anymore, for one?
Sure, that's a really good point. Well, you know, as I say, I don't make any predictions in radical evolution. What I do is I do scenarios. And scenarios are convincing stories about how the future could work, given, you know, the facts that we have on the ground right now, the kind of technologies that I'm talking about that exist in the labs. And, you know, one of the scenarios is, there's three scenarios: heaven, hell, and prevail. And the heaven scenario is the optimistic one that you talk about. And this is the one in which, in the very near future, we start to, you know, conquer pain, suffering, ignorance, stupidity, and even death. And as you know, there's a famous inventor and entrepreneur named Ray Kurzweil, and he's sort of the poster child for the heaven scenario. Ray thinks that he's immortal. He really does. He thinks that if you can live in a healthy fashion for the next 20 years, that you could live for a very, very long time, like thousands of years. And he reasons that all that has to happen is for the technologies to advance faster than you're aging. And if you've got a good enough health plan, you know, you could live for a long time. And this scenario, the heaven scenario, is not totally nuts. At the National Institute on Aging, at the National Institutes of Health, there's a bet going on right now among these very sober, serious scientists that the first person to live in a robust fashion to the age of 150 is already alive today. So the heaven scenario is credible, but it's only one scenario. Then there's the hell scenario, which is the one you talk about. And this is the one in which, okay, you've got this curve of change, but instead of it going straight up in a fashion that leads to a world that's essentially indistinguishable from the Christian version of heaven, suppose it goes straight down. The poster child for this is the inappropriately named Bill Joy, who is the former chief scientist of Sun Microsystems. And he noticed that an awful lot of these technologies are becoming dirt cheap. I mean, genetics, for example, is well within the range of, you know, any reasonably bright grad student in a well-equipped lab. And he says, you know, this is not like nuclear power that takes, you know, a country of the capabilities at least of North Korea to create. You know, any idiot can do some of these technologies. And the question is, suppose it gets into the hands of madmen or fools. One of the examples of this is the Australian mousepox incident. Did you hear about this?
No, sir.
This is the one in which Australia is an isolated ecosystem, and so from time to time it has introduced species that just run amok because they have no natural enemies. And one of these, apparently, is mice. From time to time, they're just up to their butts in mice. And so geneticists there were working on a mouse contraceptive, and instead they created a monster. They took the mousepox virus, which is a disease that affects mice, and they made one genetic tweak, and they created a virus that was 100% fatal. Every single mouse died. And then they took what they learned, and they put it on the Internet, where everybody could see it. Well, this just drives the people who worry about the hell scenario nuts, because mousepox doesn't hurt humans, but it's a very close relative of smallpox, which obviously does. And they say, my God, you know, if you give the kind of power to create this kind of evil to anybody with access to the Internet, you know, isn't it just a matter of time before somebody, you know, uses this in a fashion that that could be truly horrible? And in fact, the people who think about the hell scenario, their projection is that we could see us, they can see us wiping out the human race in the next 25 years.
Oh, yes. Joel, just let me stop you. They really did that. They created this, and they actually killed all the mice in Australia?
Yeah, 100% of the lab mice died.
Oh, my God. Of the lab mice. Did they actually
They did not get out into the wild.
Why not?
Luck. Well, I mean, the point of this is that they're saying that, you know, that knowledge of this kind of capability is essentially the same thing as the physical object. I mean, if you had an Ebola virus, for example, yes, you know, that usually, when researchers work on that, they are in stage 4 quarantine,
right,
which is an extremely elaborate way of making sure that this doesn't get out into the wild. And, you know, and people who are advocates of the health scenarios say that if you have an object that's that dangerous, you should treat the knowledge of that object with the same kind of quarantine, because the knowledge of it and the physical thing is increasingly getting interchangeable. And this is a huge argument, because right now science is entirely based on the notion that you share your insights, you share your wisdom. because nobody is as smart as all of us.
All right, Joel, hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. Joel Garreau is my guest. I just wonder, I'm curious, why, if they had this perfect thing to kill all the mice in Australia, and it worked in the lab, they didn't release it in the wild. I'm Art Bell.